Hello and welcome to Overvolted. Today we have Jim joining us.
All right, guys.
And we have Alex.
Hello.
And Aurelian.
Hello.
And we have a new face to our podcast. We have Donnie, who's our GPU review writer on Adore TV's website.
How's it going?
Today we're going to be talking about a few of the articles that we have posted on our site, such as the PlayStation 5 demo. We have a discussion about the Steam hardware survey for April. We have Aurelian's article about picking a good password. And Jim's going to talk to us a little bit about some Twitter posts and TSMC. So let's go ahead and get started. Donnie, you want to lead us off with the PlayStation 5?
Yeah, so I mean, I think most people know at this point that this week Epic did a demo for the new Unreal Engine 5. It was running on PlayStation 5 hardware, or so they say. I mean, obviously, we just assume that's true. Like,
I'm pretty sure that was true. I really hope it was true, at least.
Yeah, I would hope so. So I wrote an article about it, mostly just to kind of try to explain the what the engine like is bringing in terms of features. There's this new, there's two maybe core systems that they were introducing with the demo. One is called the Nanite system that is basically like a, it's an asset pipeline basically that allows developers to, instead of like having to create like normal maps and pre-baked assets, they can just use these like micro polygonal geometry thing. Like it's a bunch of like triangles that you can render that are the size of a pixel, and you can make assets like, basically, the entire world is made out of this. And they claim that it's not really a major impact on performance compared to traditional asset management and stuff. And then the other one is the Lumen lighting system that's like a form of global illumination that allows for fully dynamic lighting that's not ray tracing. So again, it allows developers to avoid having to do pre-baked lighting, but it doesn't have the cost of ray traced lighting.
Are none of the ray tracing elements used at all in this? I thought I read something from Sweeney recently that hinted to some type of ray tracing being used in it, or is that not true?
As far as I understand, there was no ray tracing shown off in the UE5 demo. It's all just these new UE5 features. Obviously, UE5 will support ray tracing, as far as I understand, but they were trying to show off things you can do without it.
I'm playing back the demo right now, and basically with Lumen on and off, it almost looks like they just enable HDR in a photograph. Like with Lumen off, you have the bright spots from like sunlight coming down. And then as soon as you turn Lumen on, all of the dark areas of a cave are illuminated like if you had a +2 exposure shot for HDR purposes. And they're just kind of combined together, so.
Yeah, because like, I mean, global illumination systems that are not ray tracing already exist in UE5. I guess this is just a way to enhance those to make them look better and more realistic.
Yeah, and it does a really good job at illuminating the rest of the cave based on how much sunlight is actually coming in based on the time of day.
Oh yeah, there's a very realistic like amount of high dynamic range going on in there, at least in when you see the scene where the like the top of the building is opening up and like lighting up all those statues.
Mm-hmm.
Huge contrast in lighting between the dark areas and the bright areas. Pretty amazing.
It is absolutely fantastic demo. Let's get that out the way. First of all, looks incredible.
I just hope games actually work as well as this demo, but as we know, that's usually not the case.
That's something else I did like highlight in the article is in the past, every time you've seen one of these tech demos for a new engine, especially UE, you don't really see this kind of fidelity come into fruition, at least not until maybe at the end of a console generation.
Yeah, that's a fair point as well, because I don't think we should expect to see this right off the bat as soon as, you know, the PS5 and the Xbox Series X launch. We're just not going to see this kind of fidelity, not right at the start. But later on, yeah, I think it probably could come when you get used to, you know, the developers get used to it.
Yeah, I mean, well, UE5 won't even be launching until maybe close to a year after the consoles come out.
And then you have to give the at least year and a half, 2 years lead time for the games to
be developed,
use that engine.
Yeah.
I could see them cheating with games by doing actual 3D laser scanning of real world environments like canyons and stuff just to build assets to be able to make these things look a little bit more real.
Yeah, and one of the things they were touting was their use of film grade assets, because I mean Unreal Engine now is used for film production. I think most people know that The Mandalorian, the Disney show, uses Unreal Engine for all of its environments.
One thing that was pointed out to me was, even though the environments looked absolutely spectacular, the actual characters still are very, very long way away from being photorealistic. And we did talk about photorealism in the previous podcast. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at the, you know, the protagonist, she looks like a step backward against some of the PlayStation 4 stuff in some ways. I mean, again, we're talking very early technology, but I wasn't blown away by how great she looked compared to the rest of the environment, for sure.
I would agree. The only thing I really noticed that looked good in terms of, like, from the character model perspective is the subsurface scattering for her skin was pretty good. But aside from that, yeah, she honestly kind of stood out in the entire scene because she doesn't really look like she matches.
No.
Because her fidelity versus, like, what's going on in the whole world is very different.
Yeah.
But one of the other points I wanted to bring up, and one of the main reasons why I wrote this article, was because, and the title kind of spells it out, is, like, there was a Tom's Hardware article was talking about the demo that said, that had a title something along the lines of, AMD-powered PS5 demo puts your PC to shame.
Yeah.
And to me, I took that to mean, and I think that's what the title says, is that the PS5 puts your PC to shame. And when you say your PC, obviously you mean any PC, because it's, like, you don't know who you're talking to when you're writing a title like that.
Or at least most.
Yeah, you have to at least assume you're talking the majority of PCs. And
right.
So 2060 level graphics for gamers, that is. We're not talking about someone's laptop in a business office.
Yeah, based on what Epic has said about this demo in of itself, there's no reason to believe that what they're doing here can't be done on, you know, many of the kind of mid-range, upper mid-range graphics cards that are available today, like the 2070 Super and the 5700 XT, which are similarly spec'd to what the PS5 has. I mean, of course, there's always the secret sauce and to the metal optimizations that you expect from consoles, but that's not going to, like, be the difference. Like, that's not a 50% performance difference, you know?
Sweeney did point that out on Twitter. I'll try and find that later on. He did point out that there are certain optimizations, and just the whole thing about the whole closed system does help consoles like the PS5 and the Xbox to just be a little bit better at doing certain things because it is the closed system and it is that bit more to the metal. However, you also have to consider that by the time the PlayStation 5 launches and the Xbox Series X launches, there's going to be the next generation of desktop GPUs, which will be at least 50% and could even be as much as twice as fast. Yeah. So obviously, you know, you win some, you lose some. I noticed there's some comments on Twitter. You were getting a bit of a rough time, Donnie. Like, this guy in particular, California King. Actually, most of you PC frauds have garbage PCs, and that we've seen the Steam survey, and we know what resolution and frame time you clowns are playing at, but by all means keep lying about your rigs. So I actually went on to the Steam hardware survey and had a look through all the cards that were on it, and I added up all these totals, like, percentage-wise and stuff like that, and essentially, over 40% of current Steam players today have got GPUs that are faster than an RX 580, which is comparable to the fastest game console today, which is the Xbox One X, yeah?
Yep.
But if we just go with the reasonable average console gamer who is on a PlayStation 4, 100 plus million PlayStation 4 owners. That GPU performance was an HD 7850. We're talking about a graphics card from 2012. And people playing on a PC on Steam with a better graphics card than that, you're looking at 90% plus. Yeah. So mm-hmm. This idea that console gamers are not playing with higher specs than PC gamers, not even on average, not even close, because we're right at the end of the console cycle now. And obviously it's very, very old.
That's the big thing, yeah. I think you will see a big uptick in the console gamers' experience for, you know, the value and the money that they put in for, like, the next year or two after launch. And then it's just going to start dropping down after that because stuff is going to get way further ahead and you'll get to the point where a $200 graphics card will decimate what's in a console.
Exactly. And that was a good point. This is a point that another person on Twitter made, was obviously a $2,500 PC is soon going to thrash the consoles, but any PC for around $500-$600, you've got to say that these consoles are going to be fantastic value. Absolutely fantastic value.
Oh yeah. You will not be able to beat the Xbox One X and probably the PS5.
You can barely even get the CPU for this cost. Yeah. Or the CPU and SSD. Yeah. When it comes to value for money, the consoles are going to absolutely crush any PC that we see today.
What I would be interested in seeing is how the next gen APU comes out versus these. So we're talking the Ryzen 4000 series APUs.
Always going to be hamstrung by bandwidth. They just cannot get the bandwidth. Mm-hmm. Even if they move to DDR5, consoles are now GDDR6. The bandwidth's always going to be the major problem for these APUs. And from what I've seen so far, AMD aren't really interested in changing that situation.
I wish they were. I really do. too.
Remember, it was Intel who actually went with Vega and HBM on an APU. Yeah, so they were the ones pushing the technology, but we can see that that is not really a mainstream option. Yeah, it's all about cost.
But that's why I'd be interested in seeing how the 4000 series comes out, as they would be a reasonable cost comparison.
Sure. Yeah, I think AMD is really only interested in having APU graphics that are just good enough to be better than whatever Intel's offering, and that's it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that now as well. They just want to be in a clear victory position at the low to mid-range laptop market and push it up every new series. They are pushing that, and I think that Cezanne, the one coming after Renoir, could be at a stage where it's really putting pressure on the mid-range GPUs, laptop GPUs, that is. But again, bandwidth is always going to be a problem.
I just hope they start putting 2070s and 2080s in with these AMD chips.
What is it, like top spec with a 2060 right now?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
I don't know. At some point, AMD is going to start pushing their own like high-end mobile graphics too. But, you know, I think they're meaning to have the 5600 XT mobile or whatever it's called, 5600M, launched by now in a laptop. But I guess that's been delayed. They haven't really talked about it.
But is that really going to do much more than a 2060?
Well, no, but I mean...
They need something that'll actually attract serious gamers in the 2070-2080 range.
The thing is, money-wise, though, this should be way, way cheaper with AMD selling both Zen 2 and Navi together as a package deal.
Yeah.
Obviously, the OEMs are going to want a bit of money themselves, yeah? But that can still be a saving for the similar kind of performance. I think the biggest problem with AMD is software. It is always software. They've got the hardware there that is on par or pretty close. It's good enough. And at a decent price, they could really make these compelling. However, the software simply lets them down time and time again.
Well, I'll also say that the examples that Matthew had of the software just not playing nice, or Windows itself not playing nice with the AMD integrated graphics and the NVIDIA-powered dedicated graphics, I think you're going to see more issues like that.
And you would not have those issues to worry about if it was AMD plus AMD. Yeah, this is another thing. If they just got that fixed, yeah? It's actually, I mean, I don't want to rag on AMD again, but I'm going to do it because I just seem to do it every podcast, to be honest. But if you remember Optimus, when it first came out, you had your Intel CPUs and your NVIDIA graphics, and Optimus, I hate to say this, but it just worked. Yeah, it just worked. And yet AMD couldn't even get their own APUs working properly with their own graphics cards in that same laptop. And this is what I'm talking about. When NVIDIA and Intel can get together and make software that works like that, probably because it was NVIDIA that did it, to be honest with you. But AMD can't even fix their own damn graphics and APUs together. I mean, that's a big, big difference, and it shows you why they're not breaking into the kind of areas that they should be breaking into.
It's disappointing because from all the reviews of the Ryzen Mobile 4000 series, there have been glowing reviews in terms of what the CPUs are capable of doing, right? But they're hamstrung by the fact that they're only paired with 2060s, and AMD doesn't have anything to offer on their own in terms of graphics there.
Yeah.
So when they get artificially shut out, like it feels like they're being done with right now and not being paired with 2070 and 2080, then they don't have a recourse to be able to get a laptop out there.
I agree that it's up to AMD to fix this by themselves. And with RDNA 2 coming in, and we already know it's going to be really, really efficient, especially at lower clocks, lower power. This thing's going to be amazing at that kind of level.
Mm-hmm.
They've just got to fix their bloody software. Get this fixed once and for all. And, you know, people will want it. People will buy it if they can provide the overall experience that people expect at those kind of price points.
My impression is that AMD is working on it. I think we don't yet see the fruits of it, but I have this feeling that they finally woke up and smelled the coffee about the fact that they need to figure out the software. I can't say no because I don't know it, but I have this feeling based on what I've seen around. And I hope it's also a hope from my side because I do have AMD hardware in my computer, but I do feel that they will probably be continuing on this. I hope that they will be continuing this path of fixing all the issues. And
they have to. Yeah, they've got to do it because it's the major thing holding the company back right now is the software.
And now they don't have any excuse not do it because exactly. They should have the money.
Yeah, and they've got the hardware. Before they didn't have the hardware, so it didn't really matter. But now they've got the hardware, both CPU and GPU. This is the last, maybe not the last part of the puzzle. They've got other problems like with OEMs and, you know, Intel.
MDF.
Yeah, Intel throwing around MDF, obviously. However, the things that they've got the most control over, software has to be next on their agenda for perfection, basically.
And the drivers need to be less buggy. I mean, what?
Is it just me, or was AMD's Radeon driver stack better before they did the major update recently, like for 2020? I had almost no issues with Radeon graphics cards across the board.
What I will say about that is, obviously, you had that whole thing with the black screen, the Navi stuff, the black screen and all that.
I didn't experience that until the 2020 update, though.
Funnily enough, I didn't either, but not with a Navi GPU. With my Radeon 7, the only problem I ever had was a flicker. But since they really started trying to fix the black screen stuff and all the stuff with Navi, I have found that the drivers since 2020 have been worse. And now I am black screening way more than I should be. And it has to be drivers that's causing it, because it wasn't doing it before.
Yeah, it has to be drivers.
My experience was rather stable until the December drivers. And then that one was bad. I was having issues. And then the February one was fixing my issues.
You know, here's the thing, right? Sometimes people like us, enthusiasts, we're just going to update our drivers because we're kind of trained just to do that. We see, oh yeah, there's a new driver, let's update to that one, yeah? But let's be honest, is AMD really doing anything for a Radeon 7? And have they been doing anything for Radeon 7 users and drivers for the past 6 months plus? Not very likely. And yet, I'm costing myself stability for no real reason. Maybe it's time for AMD to just say, you know, when you go to download the next driver, if you're using a graphics card that we are actively trying to like fix and or actively improving the drivers for, yeah, sure, download that. When I click on the AMD driver page and say, yeah, I've got a Radeon 7, it should give me the link to the most stable driver that they know about, which in my case would be 19.5.2, which did not flicker at all. The one and only driver that never caused multi-monitor flicker for me was 19.5.2. Every other one does it. To be honest with you, I should probably just be using that driver. And AMD should be encouraging me to use that driver, not the updated ones.
How about if we go ahead and switch to the next topic? Aurelien, you have an article about making a good password.
Yeah, I do have. Like I said in the beginning, I needed to explain my kids something about that. And I found myself in difficulties trying to find a good article that I believed in. And then I was thinking, I should probably describe the way I'm picking my passwords. And there I was. I wrote this wall of text here. I know it doesn't have pictures. It doesn't have nice... it's just text. But here we go. I wrote this article for the medium, for the not the beginner, not the most rookie guy. Also not the guys who already have very good systems for picking passwords. But for the vast majority of people who are somewhat used to or are using the electronic devices a lot, whether it's tablet, phone, PC, and so on. But they still are behind at the times with password, or let's say not keeping up to date with what secure password is. Many people have the impression that just having five letters or more password and some word or sequence of numbers or some such thing is strong enough, and they don't realize that the progress of the computing power is so fast that anything below 10 characters long, no matter how random they are, they can be brute forced immediately, so they are basically worthless. And so I went through and described the system, which is complicated, I would say, or let's say apparently complicated, not necessarily complicated. Once you get to use it, I'm using it for 15 plus years. Of course, it has been growing as I was adding more and more to it and improving the system, but that's what I use to pick my own passwords. And maybe I have been kind of criticizing or kind of downplaying a bit the use of password managers. It's just that I don't use them. I like to have my passwords in my head, so that I don't have to worry about using different devices and all that. That is not meaning on my side that they are worthless. They are legitimate use cases where they actually do make a lot of sense. And we have had a discussion on this. Me and Kirk, at least, we have been exploring this. And maybe we could think about writing an article to defend that point too. So to kind of make the case for the password managers and how you can use them to be really secure.
Yeah, I mean, that could do for another article quite fine. I'm like you as well, Aurelien. I don't use a password manager. I've always just used my own. Every so often, I'll let, you know, Chrome pick one for me if I feel that it's like really important or I'm lazy or something, yeah. But I'm not that bothered about passwords, and security is not something that interests me massively. I've been involved in it enough to know that a lot of people do have like those terrible, terrible passwords, like what you said. I remember way back, and this would be the early 90s, I was at this training program down in Ayr, which I talked about in a recent video, and I actually hacked a network down there because one of the administrators of the network had a password which was golf, G-O-L-F. And all he did all day was talk about how much he loved golf, yeah? So I got his login, and I hacked into the network using his login and the password golf. And this, I was only 16 years old at the time. But don't worry, I told him I was doing it because this was part of my my thing for the year, where I said I'm going to learn how to hack into networks and I'm going to, you know, write my sort of essay on this. Since that point, I was well aware of the, you know, how some of these passwords are simply not going to cut it. I didn't actually realize, though, that anything under 10, any sort of combination of letters under 10, letters and numbers under 10, is considered weak today.
Yep.
When you can take a encrypted password database and stick it in AWS and pay less than $200 to crack 60% of the passwords, it's done. It is done on a regular basis.
It's funny because I still have an email account from 2001 and it got hacked recently. And the title of the email was my password. And that's what caught my attention because I normally don't even bother looking at it. And I looked at it and said, that's my password in the title of this email, and it was a guy trying to con me for $2,000 worth of Bitcoin. Yeah, I just got back to him and said, look, you know, I don't give a shit about this 2001 email anymore, but if I'd see one of these emails again, then, you know, well, I better not. That was a 8-letter password using letters and numbers. That's what I was using back in 2001 as my password.
It was strong then.
Very strong then, yeah, but it's not strong now.
Let's put it this way. As part of a capture the flag security game that I was participating in, I cracked a 6-character alphanumeric password for a WinZip file. It just brute force on a laptop while driving home from said event. I was a passenger, don't worry. So I was cracking this on a laptop and managed to do it before we were 15 minutes away from the event. So yeah, this was 6 characters. Yeah, obviously, it gets exponentially harder as you get bigger, but we're talking a laptop on mobile power here, not even plugged in. Imagine what AWS would do for you.
And here's the thing. If you've got a password like some of these Star Wars Golf, which I mentioned before, I mean, these are on like a short list of things to try, first of all, yeah? So you can literally brute force these type of passwords in seconds probably today now.
And it's most likely so that the guys who are doing this professionally, they have all the databases with all the passwords, let's say up to, let's say 10, all the combinations already hashed. They just run your hash through and they get the password. They also have dictionary attack based databases already for passwords that are longer than that by using this dictionary based system where you're using many words or phrases. So you have to be aware of these things.
What's really fun, have you ever heard of rainbow tables? Those are basically pre-computed segments of passwords based on the encryption algorithm.
Wow.
Terabytes and terabytes of rainbow tables that can on the fly decrypt passwords that are without having to brute force them.
And decrypting is not like people think nowadays. I mean, you just go and you say, hey, I have stolen this hash from this website. Run it through the database. And the database tells you, yeah, to generate this hash, you need this string. And that's your password. It's instantaneous almost. It's just a database query. So it's already computed beforehand. You don't have to now start crunching that number. So people have to realize this. This is probably what I'm trying to push through this article, that they become aware. And whether they use this system or they use another system, even the vocabulary-based system, the dictionary-based system, they should start thinking seriously about the length of the passwords, how many words they use, the fact that they use numbers and characters, and start thinking about it. Because when they crack you, and if they crack your... And they should definitely stop using the same password in several places. Because if they crack through the worst, then you can be in deep shit.
Yeah. Rather than actual passwords getting more complicated for the average user, we tend to find that sites have been adding stuff like, you know, two-factor authentication and stuff like that. And obviously there is now IP checks, there are browser checks. I'm pretty sure there's a bunch of people trying to hack me every day on like YouTube. But you've also got to hack my location, you've got to kind of hack my browser, and also the two-factor. So, I mean, this is one way to mitigate weak passwords. So it's not like if you've got a weak password, you know, you're automatically going to lose it instantly. Because of these things, though, if your password is weak, though, your password should be your first line of defense, I guess, is the way to look at it.
Well, and let's not forget the password recovery methods, too.
Yeah.
Like, if you remember the iCloud gate.
Oh, yeah.
The Apple gate.
It had a better name than that.
Yes, yes. We definitely want to be a little more G-rated, I guess, but still. that whole thing was because the security questions to recover the password were weak. They had celebrities answer, what's your high school name or your high school mascot? What was your mother's maiden name? That kind of stuff.
That's how that happened?
Yeah.
That's what the questions were? And they put real answers?
Yeah, the random guy goes and just types in the security questions for celebrities, which are already all over the web anyway, because everyone knows what high school somebody went to with just a quick Google search. And so they were able to get into accounts and get the password reset with answering the security questions, which were public knowledge at that point. And it just, I laugh every time I see on Facebook friends of mine that are reposting these 20 questionnaire fun things during this lockdown, you know, where they're answering all their security questions. What's your favorite food? What's your high school? What?
I would put questions like, what's the name of the person you cheated your wife in the past 5 years?
A lot of the places, what? They don't let you type your own security question.
No. I would be the one. I mean, if I would be working for that guys, this is the security question I'd put. So tell me the name of that woman. And I'm pretty sure you're not going to tell that to anyone else.
Yeah. So obviously an extension of this picking your best password thing is also pick security questions that are obscure, not public knowledge, or just frankly answer them incorrectly but consistently. So if you, where were you born? Put Timbuktu. And obviously not that, but just because you wanted to visit Timbuktu at some point in the future. And have it be a hodgepodge.
A good one is, you know, something like, what's your favorite sports team? Pick your second favorite sports team.
And here's the thing. Also, a lot of these places, they don't encrypt these answers either. And so if they get your password in a database, they might very well get your security questions and associated answers unencrypted. And they could then use that to attack other sites. So try to pick different security questions for each site that you go to.
Yeah, that's pretty good advice, I would say.
And if all this sounds hard to remember, that's what password managers are for. Use the note field.
After this discussion, I think I am going to be paying a little bit more attention to maybe finding a decent password manager as well.
Which leads us to another thing. This podcast was brought to you by Dashlane, 1Password, and LastPass, and KeePass, since it's open source, right? No, we don't have any sponsor or anything like that, unless if they're willing. But still, I like to use KeePass as far as my password manager is concerned, so I do know that there are vulnerabilities for KeePass. If you leave it running, you can get the hash, all that. Yes, I know. But that's what key files are for too. But we will try to address that in an actual article for password managers. And yes, I will probably be the one to write that. So if everyone is utterly appalled by the fact that I will write a security article, well, you'll have to address that in the comments. Leave me some tips or whatever, and I can look that over before I actually get that article posted.
I have kind of a stupid question.
Sure.
If a password manager is open source, does that make it more vulnerable because people can actually look at the source code and figure out how to, you know, poke and prod at it?
Normally, open source software is more secure because people have a chance to look and find bugs.
Typically, yes.
Yeah, and a lot of times there's going to be more eyes looking to help fix it. And it's just a security practice to begin with. Like, you can have a secure encryption library and utilize that library insecurely. And you can also correct that with just a little bit of code after somebody points it out.
Gotcha.
Just because it's open source doesn't mean it's going to be more vulnerable. It just means that it's a little easier to find the bugs if you wanted to spend the time.
Whereas a completely proprietary thing can hide those bugs and just pretend they don't exist.
Yeah, security by obscurity in that case.
Yeah. I was just going to say the exact same thing. That's there.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's no eyes out there of security professionals that could look through your code and go, oh, you're stupid. Look, this bug right here makes this entire thing invalid. You know, there's none of that. You're just relying on this small, hopefully well-paid team of developers to write whatever section of code that they can at work, you know, because they may not have a sole focus on this one particular bit of code. They may be doing other projects as well and then just come to this on occasion to make improvements.
And also one last point, let's be honest about it. In today's world, unless you work for like as a military subcontractor or working for a bank or something, security is not the first thing that your customer is asking.
No, you're totally right.
Well, and even a lot of places that really should have security as one of the first things people ask, it's not usually the first thing people ask. I mean, even when you're talking like Colo,
Okay, moving on then to the next topic.
Yeah, let's go ahead and let Jim talk about a retired engineer Twitter post.
Yeah, retired engineer on Twitter. We follow each other. Absolutely great guy. We chat quite a bit, in fact, in private messages. And recently, he's been translating an awful lot of articles from around the web. And there's this one in particular which caught my eye this week. It was something called Ice Universe, who apparently had leaked some stuff in the past. Zen stuff or maybe console leaks, I'm not entirely sure. Bringing this up, retired engineer has translated what he said, and there was some gossip about the Zen 3 architecture Ryzen 4000 series. And internal rumors circulating among engineers at two well-known OEMs indicate that the performance of current Zen 3 engineering samples have risen to an alarming level. And judging from current information about Intel's products that these two OEMs possess, AMD's new Ryzen 4th generation will utterly beat Intel in both performance and power consumption. Now, I guess the second one we can expect, obviously, because they already do. They do it in performance as well. However, we're now talking IPC, that single-threaded monkey that is still on AMD's back. This has given the suggestion that this is now gone completely. And now, finally, AMD basically have it all. Yeah, there's no need to worry about single-threaded performance, clock speeds, that kind of thing. And he went on to say, AMD's claimed theoretical IPC improvements for Zen 3 is between 15 and 17%. Now remember, my leak was between 10 and 15%. And I reckon that this guy was pretty solid. I got more architectural information, like what was going to happen at the architectural level, but it was too specific for me to talk about. And I just won't do that. I just won't risk a source that way. He said 10 to 15%. But accordingly, in testing the Zen 3, according to this leaker, it felt better than AMD's theoretical claims, and actual performance of the engineering samples could be even better than 15 to 17%. And you know, that would line up with what Forrest Norrod said. We did sort of expect 20% plus. And I was kind of disappointed. I did say I was disappointed with my leaked information. I mean, here's the thing about leaks, right? We all want to be right. And we all want our leakers to be legit. And I believe that this guy is legit because he gave me information before which turned out right. But I wouldn't say he was like one of my main leakers or anything like that. Yeah, I just had one or two bits of information. I would like to be right, but in a case like this, if AMD are actually 20% plus IPC, I would be very, very happy if my leaker was like full of shit and this is the actual performance. If AMD can get this kind of IPC gain out of Zen 3, absolutely fantastic, yeah? I will happily.
That's absurd.
Yeah.
If it's possible. Like, that's just insane.
Like we saw with previous leaks that we've covered, the truth might actually be somewhat different than the leak based on the time that the leaker received their information.
Sure.
And so plans can change, price points yeah. can change, even the fine tuning of gigahertz and things like that can all change.
Mm-hmm.
And also IPC, it really depends what software they use to test.
Very much so.
Well, most of the time it's going to be simulated. It's all going to be simulated IPC yeah. in a CPU before they even bake the chip.
Before they even have the chip to test. And then they suddenly yeah. get the chip back and it's like, holy shit, this is like even way, way better or even just better than what we expected. What I would say about this particular one is two OEMs. I'm not entirely sure who this is. It could be server guys. Also, I've got some very, very good server contacts. Or it could be, you know, guys like your Asus, your Gigabytes, your MSIs. It could be those are also OEMs, obviously, on the desktop side of things. So it's difficult to know. I would say that I would have thought I would have heard from one of them if this was the case. But I don't hear everything. It's a case of, I don't know, it's worth just throwing out here, this thing for the whole podcast. If Zen 3 is even better than what my leak suggested, then I'm going to be absolutely delighted. And I hope it is. Yeah, I really hope it's as good as this. I wonder what the prices will be like, though.
And if you're listening, Jim's email is jim.parker@adoretv.com. I'll be like Al on Home Improvement, you know, just holding up the sign.
I'll be honest with you. I thought we wouldn't see that many improvements in Zen 3, but the possibility that these improvements will be there
I'll tell you what my feeling was on this, Alex. My feeling was what Forrest Norrod said a while ago made me strongly believe it was 20% plus. And then when I heard 10 to 15, I was a little bit disappointed in that. But when I looked and when I saw like the list of changes, I thought, how can it only be 10 to 15% with these changes? I mean, I felt disappointed in it because I really expected more. And now, if we do get more, absolutely great. If not, then...
They're going from Zen 2 to Zen 3, not Zen 2 to 2 plus. And
yeah.
Unifying the cache is not enough of an architectural change to really say, oh, Zen 3 now. So I definitely expected some architectural changes and whatnot to help improve IPC in particular.
Well, I don't know. I mean, unifying the cache, you're basically talking about doubling the cache, yeah?
But that's not necessarily an IPC thing. That's more of a thread hopping thing. It'll improve IPC for a thread that hops, but in multi-threaded, it's going to be significantly better. But
yeah.
We're talking single-threaded IPC.
Single-threaded IPC. I did actually mention that during the leak as well, because I was told single-threaded IPC, 10 to 15%. Mm-hmm. But the multi-threaded stuff could be an awful lot nicer, and perhaps that's what it was that maybe why it's slightly lower for me.
We just got a tantalizing taste of how it's going to work based on the 3300X. And that's four cores on a single CCX.
Yeah, and that's still Zen 2.
I'm really excited to see what those eight cores are going to be like on a single CCX.
Yeah, that would certainly explain the difference in the numbers that I was given. Because remember, mine was single-threaded IPC. That's what I was told, between 10 and 15. But the multi-threaded stuff, yeah, it could be quite a lot nicer.
What's even going to be nicer than that is we're going to be doing a more mature TSMC process as well, so the clocks are obviously going to be higher.
So yeah, this is going to be basically 7 plus, right? Across the whole chip, right?
You think so?
I'm not sure about the I/O die.
I was going to say, I don't know if they're still going to use 14 for the I/O die or 12.
I would think that because of their glow flow obligations, they're probably still going to have an I/O die at the 12 nanometer that glow flow is.
For contractual reasoning, not for necessarily the cost.
They have to get so many chips from GlobalFoundries in order to satisfy their purchasing agreement.
Mm-hmm. Interesting thing was, I was told a very long time ago that Milan, this generation upcoming, would actually be 7 nanometer CPU cores and 7 nanometer I/O. So that was the plan at one time. And when I say that that was the plan, I'm pretty confident in that, yeah, because these are the same guys that told me that it was going to be chiplets in the first place. And, you know, one was at TSMC and the 14 nanometers was at GlobalFoundries. So there's no doubt in my mind that that was the plan at one time. I'm not convinced it's going to be the plan right now.
Yeah, that's 2-3 years ago. So it's,
yeah, that was a couple of years ago.
Times can change, things can happen.
Also, to head off everybody at the pass, Jim has been remarkably accurate in his leaks. The biggest thing that you could really criticize was the pricing, which is always subject to change.
Yeah, just look at the 5700 XT.
I'm never touching pricing in a leak again, ever. Absolutely
not.
Or
at least not with any definiteness, that's for sure.
Absolutely not. I'm not even going to guess. I'm just going to leave the pricing out of it altogether. There is nothing to be gained.
Pricing is a marketing sales thing, you know, what they can get out of it.
Yeah.
And they could throw the price out there, let people react to it like, oh, look how expensive it is. And then, you know, drop it by $50 like they did.
Mm-hmm. With Navi.
Jebaited, yeah. We could all be jebaited, yeah.
Although it was probably Jim baited rather than Jeb baited.
Wow.
You had that as a video title before,
it
didn't
did,
you?
Yeah. Jim baited, yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so moving on to the final topic.
TSMC.
Yeah. This was an interesting one because I think it was Tweaktown a couple of weeks ago, maybe a week ago, said that TSMC were going to be opening up a new fab in the USA, and Intel were involved as well at this point. And I thought, well, Intel's already got fabs in the USA. TSMC to do one as well?
They're in a majority, yeah.
I haven't really looked an awful lot into this itself. I noticed that Ian Cutress over at Anitech, he's had quite a lot to say on it on Twitter at least. So we might see an article about that over at Anitech, and I hope so.
I like his takes a lot.
Yeah, Ian's a great guy, and he knows his tech obviously better than most people does.
I mean, he eats the chips.
Yeah, he eats the chips, so obviously he should know a bit more about them than most. But this was a pretty interesting story. What I found interesting about this was I actually found this article from researching my current video, which will be out hopefully by the before you actually see this podcast. But this came from 2019-11. So we're talking the 25th of November last year. And I had a good look through this and I got to this point. So I better tell you what the article's about. It's about leaving Samsung behind with high yield rate. So TSMC, I've got a much better yield rate on 7 nanometers than Samsung has. And DigiTimes, I believe, leaked this at some point. I had a look through this article and near the bottom, key to success number 4, this is for TSMC, Intel may be fading out. And then a little bit down from this, TSMC has won the battle. Now, this was really telling to me because a long-time Silicon Valley entrepreneur who didn't want to be named, involved in integrated circuit design, who is familiar with Intel, has told this magazine that for the past few years, he thought that it was wishful thinking that TSMC would be able to take on Intel. But he now admits to TSMC's ascendance, saying, "The battle is over. TSMC has taken over the semiconductor industry." Now, I've been saying this for a couple of years now as well, so that's maybe not a great surprise to a lot of people, but this is an Intel person saying this as well. But what was really, really telling here was this part. When he came out and said that after Intel was forced to farm out some of its lower level chipsets to TSMC, we remember that, yeah? Because of the huge shortfall in its own 14 nanometer production. The word was that when the new Intel CEO, Robert Swan, heard of TSMC's quote, when Intel went to TSMC and said, "How much do we fab this on 14 nanometers or whatever?" And when Swan heard the quote, he could not believe how low it was. And the final part of this was, "That shows that this order will not be going back." In other words, TSMC are in the lead and it is unassailable. Forget about the actual fact that they're in the lead in technology. The cost, they can manufacture this so much cheaper than Intel. Intel's own CEO could not believe how low the quote was. Now, you think about that when you're Intel, and you've got tens of thousands of guys working fabs, and they're costing a fortune, and you could really use something like TSMC in the USA to maybe bring you back into the equation a bit. I mean, maybe that's just pure tinfoil hattery or a major conspiracy theory, but I would not be surprised if there is something in this here. And obviously, you're all Americans apart from Aurelian. We know that Trump said something about throwing money or whatever, that the US government said something about they really, really wanted this technology in America as well. So, I mean, all the parts are there for this to make sense to me. Intel could use TSMC's expertise or they are going to be irrelevant. I mean, the other side of the equation is, what does TSMC gain out of it? Could be a lot of money in this for them as well. And if they don't feel threatened, if they don't really feel threatened by Intel anymore, which they shouldn't.
Well, just imagine how logistically important a fab in, say, Chandler, Arizona, where Intel already has fabs, could be for them in their product pipeline. If that fab started churning out Intel chips, they would be in the same city and able to just truck those chips over and join whatever Intel was kicking out and run straight through their pipeline.
And what Intel needs most is volume. Intel needs massive volume or it's useless to them.
And they don't have to wait a month for a shipping container.
Shipping over, basically, from Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So that just made me wonder, is there a story there that goes a little bit further than what meets the eye? I'm not sure.
And we know with the whole political landscape, they're going to get a lot of incentives, mainly in the realm of tax breaks and whatnot, to put up this factory. So it was probably a no-brainer for them.
And we were talking earlier, just before we started the podcast, that Intel has got so much manufacturing, but most of it is in the USA, yeah? They've got that fab over in Ireland, but most of the heavy manufacturing is happening in Oregon and Arizona, isn't it?
Yeah, Hillsboro, Oregon has a lot of their older fabs from the early 2000s. And then Chandler has some of the more recent fabs, as well as a new projected one. 7 nanometer, they got a one in Chandler as well as the 14.
Yeah. What Ian Curtis from Anitech said on Twitter was, even if they break ground on it tomorrow, it's still going to be years away.
Oh, yeah. These things don't go up overnight.
No, absolutely not. So it does make me wonder from that perspective, is there really a story there or not? As usual, with most of the stories on the podcast. It's a wait and see sort of game. Just, we're going to be waiting for more information. Are we going to hear more about this, or is it a non-starter to begin with? Will Intel even be here in 5 or 6 years' time?
As a company? Or just in fabrication?
But that's another thing. I mean, there's a lot of talk about Intel spinning off their fabs for good reason, yeah?
Because they probably should.
And if they did that, then they would no longer be any kind of threat to TSMC. And, I mean, TSMC would look at the sheer volume that Intel can provide, and they could expand, like... I mean, obviously, Apple gives them a huge amount, and Huawei, and even AMD.
Qualcomm, too.
I mean, AMD are a massive customer now for TSMC. But Intel, though, I mean, there's another level entirely. You know, if TSMC could get that business and Intel became just like AMD and NVIDIA, basically that would cement TSMC as the world leader forever, basically, in semiconductors.
I mean, at that point, you might have to start looking at TSMC for antitrust violations.
You could do. Yeah, I mean, there is a thing there, but in the end, if you look at Intel losing competitiveness anyway... You've still got Samsung there as well, who look like they could be falling to the wayside a little bit. We've already lost GlobalFoundries at 7. There's only a couple left there. But in the end, I mean, I don't think the antitrust or the monopolies guys can look at it and say, no, Intel can't do that because it'd make TSMC too powerful. The problem there would be if Intel doesn't do it, Intel, you know, they're screwed because they cannot keep up anyway.
Oh. I'm not suggesting the antitrust would stop, like those guys would stop it from happening. But once it does happen, you know, 5-10 years down the road, TSMC is going to have some problems on their hands in terms of monopolization.
Like, the biggest problem for them would be somebody like Apple, who would hate to watch the prices rising all the time. And, you know, NVIDIA, which I'm going to talk about in my next video, actually. NVIDIA already didn't like the rising prices on 7 nanometers, and they weren't the only ones. But you can imagine TSMC, if they are the actual monopoly supplier of silicon, Apple's not going to like that. They're not going to enjoy looking at those prices creeping up and creeping up. Intel wouldn't like it either. But in the end, we're talking about actual expertise here, where nobody else seems to have it. Nobody wants a monopoly, yeah? I would love GlobalFoundries to come back. I would love Samsung to get their act together.
Has GlobalFoundries said anything about their plans going forward, or they're just going to stop at 12?
I think they'll get to 7 eventually, when it's a lot cheaper.
Yeah, when it becomes cheap to buy the machines.
They all go the same way, yeah? All the fab guys go the same way. When Chartered started falling behind, UMC as well, and SMIC... they all just get to the next node that little bit slower. UMC got to 14 nanometers a year later than the other guys. I think Charter dropped out at 28 or something, or 32. But it always slows down. Just like Intel's doing, basically. Yeah, they're slowing down now. It's not a money thing at Intel, though. It's an expertise thing. The rest of the guys, it's normally money. It's been money that stopped them from getting there. And 7 nanometers is still extremely expensive. But the costs will come down. And hopefully GlobalFoundries will make more money. They are making money, but sadly they still lose a lot of money. I think they probably lose more. But at some point, hopefully they will get to 7. However, I mean, we already know that TSMC are going to 5, yeah? Intel will be on 7 next year. TSMC have got a roadmap to 3 nanometers in a couple of years. They are not stopping.
This is mind-boggling.
Yeah, it looks like endgame to me. Really does look like the fabrication endgame. It's not that far away.
It's pretty clear at this point that Intel, like you said, does need to consider spinning off their fab because they need to be a much more agile company and not be reliant on their own manufacturing capabilities for the future of their product.
Yeah, I don't know what the problem is.
And I mean, when you get up to 3 nanometers, isn't that sort of the getting to the really high upper reaches of what silicon can do in terms of still being a working transistor?
1 nanometer, I reckon. Think that 1 nanometer is the end of the CMOS. I mean, the difference between 3 and 1, it's not absolutely massive, obviously, as you can probably figure. Yeah, we're getting to the end of it, but I think they've got ways to keep it going.
It's also worth noting that 5 nanometer, 3 nanometer, these are all marketing terms for what they call their manufacturing process. That's not the actual size.
Yeah, that's not the feature size. It is a lot of marketing, obviously. The only thing we really need to, the only thing that we know is that TSMC are the leader. And they're not slowing down at all. In fact, they may be speeding up here. To me, it looks like endgame's not that far away here. And with that, we can move on to the question and answers.
Aurelian has the Q&A that he has prepared for us. So let's go ahead and dive straight into that, especially since we have a newcomer, Donnie, which rounds out our entire writing team at this point.
You met all of us.
So we don't have so many questions for today because we have been speaking a lot and this is too long. So let's go through some very simple ones. So
it's still a half hour podcast. Don't worry.
Yeah, always is, guys. Okay.
Yeah, 30 minutes.
So let's go. What games are you guys playing right now?
Unbelievably, I am playing Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, which is a game that I bought 7 years ago. I think it's an Unreal Engine 3 or 4 game. It's actually a really nice little game. You know that I play RPGs and I've just been going crazy recently these past couple of weeks trying to find stuff to do. I haven't really been throwing out videos, you probably noticed, yeah? So I've tried to get some gaming done while it's been quiet. I mean, I've even got stuff on my desktop here like Star Wars Jedi Knight Jedi Academy. I mean, how old is that game? Torchlight 2, which I tried out again. And then finally I went back to this one, Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning. Yeah, I've actually enjoyed this quite a lot.
The story behind that game is just tragic. Not the story in the game, but the development and what happened to the studio and everything. Is
I didn't actually follow that, but I'll have a look at it now that you've said that. I've enjoyed it, though. I've got to say, I've played about maybe 5 or 6 hours of it these past few days, and I've been quite enjoying it. Otherwise, Total Warhammer 2. Played a lot of time in that. I'm not really playing Warcraft anymore, either. But this is what's getting my attention right now, is Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning.
Yeah, I'm in a bit of an in-between phase waiting for Shadowlands for World of Warcraft as well. So I haven't been playing that. And I've also been working on website, podcast, and even school. So I haven't had a whole lot of chance to play games either. But I did take advantage, and not to sound too sponsored or anything, but I did take advantage of the Microsoft Xbox subscription discount that they're offering this month because of the lockdown.
Then how much was that?
$1.
I thought that was always $1.
No, they discounted the $15 a month subscription for their like pro or whatever premium live service. And so it's $1 for this month. And so I took advantage of that to get access to their library. And I've been playing Forza Horizon 4. I actually stayed up way too late last night. That's why
it's an amazing game.
It's so good.
That's why you were able to chat with me on Discord so late for me, early for you.
Forza Horizon 4 is absolutely fantastic. It really is. I was looking at playing it again yesterday. It is an amazing game. Again, we're not sponsored here in any way. I just really, really enjoyed that game.
I'm just disappointed they haven't come out with a decent sale. Like, it's 30% off right now for another day. Once again, not sponsored. But
here's the thing, though. Are you using the wheel or a controller or keyboard and mouse for the game?
A controller. I like racing games a lot. And I'll do it with the controller, even though I would probably enjoy a wheel mount setup. So if there's any manufacturers that make wheel mounts, I'd be more than happy to review one. Just saying. But I'm doing the controller because I can drift pretty well with that. And I just have to get the physics down of every racing game that I play because I'm sensitive enough to the mechanics and actual racing that I can see the different mechanics. And Forza does an extremely good job at giving different vehicles a different feel and reaction to your controller.
I think that's what gripped me about that game because it felt like playing Gran Turismo 1. Like,
I was a big Gran Turismo 1 fan.
Yeah. Yeah, you could feel the difference in every single car that you drove, and you can feel the difference in the upgrades, like your better tires and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what gripped me, I think, about that game.
And actually really giving realistic response.
I put a crazy amount of hours in.
Like, I had a car that all I had to do was adjust the camber just a little bit on the tires, and the thing started handling a lot better. And all I did was drop it from the zero camber down to about a minus 2.5, and it gave me some great handling. I started flying around corners a lot better, and just to get that kind of a response without changing anything else about the car.
It's the first thing that I do in all these games, like even Gran Turismo and Forza Horizon. I don't bother with the engine and the aerodynamics. The first thing you do is you stick on the best tires that you can get for that car. And the handling is just so, so much better with best tires.
That's what I actually saw IRL when I took my car out to the track, is I went and ran it on nearly bald tires in a winter condition, and it started snowing on me, and I actually spun out. But I changed the tires after that because this was my last FU to my tires, right? I just was going to burn them up and then replace them because they were all on the end of their life. So I replaced them after that, got some good stickies. Still some street tires, but some really good sticky street tires. Yeah. And went back out to the track on a clear day and was able to improve my lap time significantly.
Yeah.
I have those videos on YouTube if you want to laugh and make fun of me. So by all means.
Maybe check those ones out then.
Yeah, it shouldn't be too hard to find them. They're associated with the account that I like to comment on these videos with. So not plugging my other channel or anything, but kind of plugging my other channel. You can also see all the previous revisions of this podcast from before I started at Adored on one of my other channels.
Yeah.
I've been playing a lot of, I haven't really been playing any like story-driven games recently. It's mostly just online like multiplayer stuff. I've been playing a lot of Valorant because that's what my friends play because it's new.
What's that called?
Valorant. It's a multiplayer competitive shooter.
Right.
Like first person shooter.
We're not going to call it Overwatch or anything.
No, it's not Overwatch. It's more,
it's more like Counter-Strike.
It's more like Counter-Strike, but it does have elements from a game like Overwatch.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember seeing that one. One of the guys here has got a beta key for it. They were giving away beta keys, I think. And it does look like Counter-Strike mixed with Overwatch, you know, in a lot of ways. But it looks more like Counter-Strike, but mm-hmm. yeah, with Overwatch elements, what you said.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got the hero abilities stuff going on. But, I mean, if you like Counter-Strike, you'll probably like Valorant. It's made by the guys who make League of Legends, Riot Games.
Yeah.
And my only gripe with it...
It installs a rootkit into your system.
Yeah, my only gripe with it is the anti-cheat is a rootkit.
So ring minus that. One.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been playing most of the games that he has because we share a lot of the same friend groups. So I've been playing Valorant. I've been playing some Escape from Tarkov. And I probably spent more time than I should have once I got the 3300X review done playing Gears Tactics. Gears Tactics is really good if you like XCOM style games. It's
yeah, I love XCOM well games. Done.
You should pick up the $1 a month trial with Xbox Live Game Pass.
I think
Ultimate
I will do then.
Something.
I had it before. I actually had it right at the start. I didn't realize mm-hmm. they'd raised the price on it, but yeah, maybe I will do that.
I mean, again, not sponsored, but I personally think the Xbox Game Pass is like the best deal in gaming, especially on the PC right now. There's so many good games on there. I love Halo, and Halo 2 just dropped on there, and I've been playing some of that too, and some Gears 5, and just a lot of fun.
I mean, even the normal price, I think, is like $5 a month for the regular one.
Aurelian, what are you playing right now?
Well, I'm a bit of an older fart than you guys. I'm playing a lot of Counter-Strike and Dirt Factor 2.
Yeah.
Sorry, Dirt Rally 2. I'm mixing it with R Factor 2, which I also play sometime.
Okay.
And online chess. I enjoy playing. If I have like 20 minutes and I want to kill some time, I start a chess game and I enjoy it.
I haven't played chess in so long.
Yeah, same.
It's fun. And nowadays with these online platforms, it's nicer. It definitely... much better than playing against an AI, which is dry.
Yeah.
Not fun, because people make mistakes, and that's the whole fun of playing chess.
Rather than being perfect at everything.
I used to play poker, online poker, but after I lost some money, I said, fuck it. I'm not good at it. I mean, I'm good at having playing a $10 game at the party, but not online. Online is full of sharks, so
yeah.
Yeah,
you're going to lose a bunch of money doing that.
All right. So let's go on. So have the second question would be also on a personal note is what is your favorite food or foods?
While we're trying to suss out, you know, special answers for secret passwords. Favorite food is one of the questions that are asked as a security
pizza
question.
Pizza 1, 2, 3.
Pizza 1, 2, 3. Yeah. Just don't answer those questions truthfully, except for here, of course, we always answer the truth in the podcast, but just don't answer them truthfully on the question.
Wait,
recovery.
We're supposed to tell the truth? I've been doing this wrong this whole time.
Well, now I'm confused. I don't know what to do here, but my favorite food is, that's a tough one. I'm a foodie, so like I have so many things I love.
Same.
But like if there was only one thing I could eat and like everything else had to die, I mean, it's pretty simple. I'd pick pizza every time.
100%.
I would have picked pizza every time maybe a year ago because pizza was my favorite food and it always has been. However, I recently became a vegan and honestly, vegan cheese is the worst thing ever you can imagine. It just...
Oh man.
Vegan cheese is an oxymoron.
Just go get the Incredible Burger.
Yeah. I mean, Incredible Burgers are okay, to be honest with you.
I had one before, it's fine.
Yeah, I think that they do taste like meat, I think, which is why I'm not super keen on them. But yeah, back on topic. Sorry, Donny, I managed to hijack your part of it.
I think pizza is about all you need to say.
Pizza was my favorite, and it would still be had I not become vegan, like within the past year or so. Do you have a second?
So your favorite food is soy, right?
Well, my favorite food now would be... I'm going to have to think about it while the rest of you guys tell me what yours is.
Plants.
Got to list all the vegetables in his head.
Rutabaga.
I'll go. I'm really, really boring. There are tons and tons of foods that I enjoy and absolutely love, but there is nothing like a really, really, really well-prepared steak and, you know, steakhouse mashed potatoes. There is, like, nothing that beats that.
So the opposite answer to Jim. Okay.
What's that?
The opposite answer to Jim.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. No. I'm totally a carnivore.
What? It has potatoes.
True.
Yeah, I could eat that.
Steakhouse mashed potatoes with butter.
You can just scrape the meat off it for me, yeah.
And no bacon on that potato either.
Yeah. No sour cream either.
Just put the potato out there because you can't put the butter. Unless if it's vegetable oil.
This doesn't sound fun. Jim, you are a much stronger man than I am. Just for living this way.
It's surprisingly easy. It really is. I mean, but then again, I've been doing it for years, so that's probably why.
Now, is it a political choice or a personal choice?
It's personal choice, yeah. I gave up meat when I was 13 years old, which was 31 years ago now that I have been meat-free. Becoming the vegan was like a new step that I made last year because since I moved to Sweden, I can no longer trust what I read on labels because some of it says it's vegetarian, but when you look at the actual details of the ingredients, you find that what they call vegetarian is not really what would be counted as vegetarian in the UK. For example, it might have cheese that is made out of calf rennet. Yeah, so basically, you know, the guts of a young calf is made to like create the cheese. Whereas in the UK, oh, wow. that would never be allowed to be counted as vegetarian in the UK.
Especially a young calf.
I don't know how that would be.
That's what most cheese is made out of, though. It's called calf rennet.
Yeah, yeah.
Most of the cheese that you eat is probably got calf enzymes,
inerts.
At least from the guts of a calf. Yeah?
Mm. Yeah.
And I mean, there's no vegetarian would ever tolerate that. Yeah. So I actually had to get. I gave up cheese altogether. And then the next natural step was giving up milk and butter as well. You know, you get vegan alternatives to everything. So it's really not that much of a hassle. It's really not.
But to clarify this cheese thing so that people who don't know it are not horrified. So the milk needs to start fermenting to get the cheese. And you can use bacteria cultures that you... And one way, factories use it. But another way to do it, and that's the traditional way to do it, you use the inside flora that is in the intestines of the calves. And you use that flora, bacterial flora, to start the fermenting process of the milk. And so if people didn't know, probably they also didn't know that honey is bee spit or something, but that's the truth. It just is like that.
So, I mean, based on all this, I would say my favorite food is probably corn bolognese. Corn was a very old manufacturer of like vegetarian food long before like Beyond Meat and all that came along, which happened recently. So corn have been around for like 1990 or something, 1985 in the UK. And they make corn mince, they make corn burgers, and that was basically what I grew up on. So I would say corn bolognese, handmade by myself, is probably my favourite food. And if that's all I could eat every day, like Donny said, that's probably what I would eat.
Has everybody else answered? Kirk, you didn't, or did
you? I did. I agreed with Donny 100%. Pizza is very flexible, and it's a very loose definition.
You can put a lot of different toppings on it.
Like, I like dessert pizza. I like normal pizza. I don't like pineapple on my pizza.
Me neither.
I love pineapple on my pizza. Yeah, give me pineapple every day.
Mm-mm, not for me. It's an abomination.
While we're talking divisive things, pineapple does not belong on pizza.
No, I can't do it. I think it's unnatural and just an affront to all that's right.
You know, this is funny, right? Because we've been talking about food for the past 2 or 3 episodes, right? We had the whole Coke Pepsi thing, yeah? We had the broccoli thing, and I have noticed that I have definitely got completely different taste buds from most people. I like Pepsi, I like... I guess most people said that they did prefer Pepsi, but I like broccoli.
You said that Coke tastes like vegetables, but you like broccoli and other vegetables, but yet you don't like Coke even though it tastes like vegetables.
I don't like Coke even though it tastes like vegetables, yeah. If it tasted like broccoli, though, maybe I would.
I like broccoli. I like broccoli a lot.
I think I made the point in the Discord that I love steak, but if you gave me a drink that tastes like steak, I wouldn't drink that.
Yeah. Just like the bacon-flavored soda.
It's unnatural to have something that tastes that way, like as a drink.
Yeah. It's not quite the same.
I like eating bacon, but bacon-flavored soda?
I'd try it.
Probably not. Yeah, probably not.
I'd try it once, but I it's probably terrible, yeah.
Okay, go ahead and give us the last question if you got one.
I would like to answer this as well and then go. Sure. I'll be fast. So, like everybody, I mean, I also like pizza and I also like pasta and all these things. And I can appreciate a well-made steak and all this. And I always eat my steak rare. I can't eat it well done or even medium. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Jim.
That's fine.
Actually, as a side note, when I went last time to a restaurant, a very good restaurant here, that they make good steaks, I said that I'd like it screaming. And she looked at me, what do you mean? I want when I poke it, I want the steak to scream at me back. But anyway, but I would say that the one food that I like to eat would be, I think, sushi. I really like sushi. I've been discovering it recently, and I think there's a lot of variety there, and I like it.
I quite enjoy that, too. It's pretty good stuff.
All right, so maybe the last question, maybe. What could it be? On the serious side or on the funny side?
Let's do funny.
Funny. Okay. Okay, now for everyone. I don't know what order you guys want to go, but would you rather know how you will die or when you will die?
Wait a minute. Did Kipnock say funny?
It's funny because I'm curious to hear the your argument.
This is very German.
I mean,
funny,
if this is what
you
think,
funny,
you're really in a bit.
It's a European funny.
Come okay, on. How or when?
This is the gulags kind of funny.
Oh my god. Oh, how or when? Oh, damn, that is a good question.
I have my answer. I can go right now.
Go.
When? The reason why I want to know when is I can't make this funny. It's just dark. I don't know. I'd rather have the understanding of the time rather than the question of exactly how it'll happen.
That's not funny. That's just real.
No, there's not really a funny way.
I've got my answer.
I think part of the question involves the ability to change the outcome. Like if you knew how you were going to die, can you change that outcome? Or is it like Final Destination where you're going to die regardless of how much you try to avoid it? You just die in an unpredictable way.
That's exactly how I was analyzing that as well, Kirk.
Same.
Right there.
My answer was going to be like how, because then I can try to change it. I can avoid that shit when I see it coming.
If you're going to die from brain cancer, it's going to be kind of hard to avoid that. So
initially, I immediately thought I didn't want to know the when because that seemed like it wasn't so much in control or I wasn't in control of that. But the how, maybe I could control that. And so I could avoid that situation somehow. However, I then realized that I was probably going to spend the rest of my life wondering about this and trying to avoid it. And so I would now say that I would rather know when and just deal with it, yeah?
Well, with that answer in mind,
I hate to taint everyone.
Yeah. I now think that I would say, I would also say when, but to be completely honest with you, I'd rather not know either of these.
Yeah, obviously.
I'm very happy with not knowing either of those.
Like, yeah. Ignorance is bliss here.
All right, maybe that was on the dark side.
Maybe?
Just a bit.
For my answer, I would take the when, not the how, as well. Just because if you know when, whatever allotment of time that is, you can now make plans for the future. If you knew you were going to die next year, would you really hold off buying that 2080 Ti or...
Yeah,
you know, just buy it, right?
No, do you want to spend the rest of your life not without ray tracing?
I know, right? RTX on.
You know, Kirk, I was going to say the exact same thing again.
This podcast has been sponsored by NVIDIA.
Would you recap your memories? How many of those do you not want to be ray traced?
I wish Matthew was here.
Well, think of it. I just had a friend of mine lose his wife recently, not to bring the tone mm-hmm. down, but he lost his wife recently to cancer, and his sage advice during the last few weeks of her life was, to me, enjoy the time that you have and do it to the fullest. You know, don't necessarily say, we'll do that when we retire, or we'll do that next year. You know, if you have the opportunity to spend time with those that you love, or to do the things that you want to do today, go do them. You know, obviously don't take a loan against your house and go into the debt and all that to do some of these things, but don't be so worried about saving for tomorrow when you can have the opportunity and the health to do it today.
Yeah, I think we can all agree with that.
Well, I think another thing too is, there are some really, really great examples of art that people have put out when they knew their time was coming. So I think there's sort of a, if you know exactly when it's going to happen, I think there's a certain amount of acceptance that you just get from it, and a clarity that other people just don't have.
Yeah.
So, Not to bring country music into it or anything, but they have country music about that. Live like you are dying.
I'm not really surprised by that for some reason.
I mean, so have you guys ever heard Johnny Cash's cover of Hurt? I'm sure you guys have.
Who's Johnny Cash?
No, just kidding.
That's a cover?
Yeah, it's a Nine Inch Nails song.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And just to not let it on this dark, dark note, coffee or tea? Quickly.
Tea.
Coffee.
Tea.
Coffee. I didn't hear Kirk.
Once again, not to sponsor anything, what is Rockstar Energy considered, a coffee or a tea? Because that is my drink of choice right now.
It's whatever you want it to be at that point.
We should be making a fortune on these, to be honest with you, yeah? Why are we not making a lot of money on these podcasts, guys?
I'm not sharing at the moment.
It's because, unfortunately, brands have freedom of association.
And does anybody want to sponsor us? Like, come on, somebody.
If we're willing to give the advertisements for free, why would they want to pay us, right?
Yeah, that is that.
Well, I'm not putting any pictures of any of these products in this podcast just because they're not paying us. But
was that
I don't like the taste of coffee, and I'm not really into teas either. Like, I haven't had any good ones that I can name. So they all taste like dirt, in my opinion. Talking about weird taste buds, Jim. But Rockstar Energy drinks, I actually like the flavor. I went through quite a few different types, and this is the one that I'm kind of settled on. So whatever that equates out to, both, I don't know.
I only drink energy drinks when I drive long, long time. Like if I drive 20 hours straight, then I'll take a Red Bull. But I stay away from those.
Well, like I said, I was up
abnormally
late. Well, maybe not for me abnormally, but quite a lot late last night playing Forza. So just to tie in both sponsored comments, right?
Yeah,
of course.
Oh, the commenters one day are going to find out about how much money we're making from all the product placements. I mean, not making.
You keep talking about Microsoft games and energy drinks. You're going to be the next Jeff Keighley.
We're not making. No. Yeah. So the next racing vid I make, if you see me driving around in a GTR, it'll probably have Rockstar branding on it, maybe.
Maybe not. And with that, guys, I think we'll call this one to an end.
All right. Thank you guys for joining us, and especially Donnie for being able to make it to his first ever podcast. And obviously, Alex, Aurelian, and Jim, thank you guys for joining us this week. Jim almost didn't join us. He's been working pretty hard on his video. He's slaving away on it, so hopefully we'll see that this week. Hint, hint.
Yep, we will see that within the next 2 or 3 days.
I'm sure we're all anxiously awaiting it. So with that...
But wait a minute, though, because I expect that to be out before the podcast, so...
Oh, you're doubting my abilities.
No, I'm just saying that that's hopefully going to be out within the next 2 or 3 days, and you do have a lot of editing to do for this one, Kirk.
We're at an hour and 29 minutes for runtime, so I'm not sure how quick I'll be able to churn this one out without losing some audio quality. So if you guys were okay with that, I can get it out sooner. But be sure to hit that like button, subscribe, hit the alarm, check out the website, go to the Patreon, all the comments.
Money.
Oh, yeah, there you go. You can directly donate to us with PayPal or Bitcoin. Those are all in the description.
I mean, if you want us to stop trying to shill a company, I'm sorry. I'm going to stop.
Pay us to stop.
Well, that's why we haven't named any specific companies for like pizza, you know, Domino's, Pizza Hut. Let me go down this list and with the dollar amounts in order. So be sure to comment as well. That helps with our SEO. Give us an upvote and all that other happy stuff. And we will see you in the next one.
Later.
We'll catch you later, guys.